You have reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave your message after the tone.
Hello, my name is LV. So I'm curious about where the whole thing of the color blue being for guys and the color pink being for girls started. I know, like, pink woman, like vaginas, but, like, men don't have blue testicles or something. I don't know. I would freaking love to hear from you. Bye.
Hello.
Hey, LV, it's Flora from Every Little Thing.
Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. Just so you know, I hope you know, I'm recording right now for my YouTube channel. Do you mind if you say hi to my YouTube people?
Hi, YouTube people.
I'm still freaking out. Okay, I'm ready.
What got you curious about pink and blue?
Okay, so kind of the trigger of this one question was a baby shower at my job, and I ask my coworkers, oh, so do you guys know if the baby is going to be a girl or boy? And they looked at me with like a huge, like, are you dumb kind of face. And I looked around and everything was pink. And they're like, well, duh, it's pink. It's a girl. And I was wearing a pink sweater that day. And I was like, okay, so I guess I'm a girl. And yeah, I was like, poking the bear, because I was like, yeah, so I'm a girl, right? I'm a girl. And then this one coworker that's really close to me and she's pregnant, she got super offended. She said, if you bring something pink to my son's baby shower, I'm going to throw a fit and I'm going to go off. And I was like, what the hell? And then I just became curious and I was like, wow, maybe there's a story behind pink and blue.
Why were you poking the bear about this?
I don't like gender norms. They have always like kind of bothered me just because I'm a very like feminine and like androgynous like boy, just very naturally. And I like to wear heels sometimes. I let my hair grow long, but I'm Latino and I'm Mexican and I come from like a more like religious, old fashioned, you know, like the way I was raised. So long hair on men was like a huge no-no.
What about pronouns for you?
Oh, okay, pronouns. I don't even care. He, she, because sometimes like I'm at the mall and I'm walking and I swear to you, I'm not wearing any makeup. I'm wearing like my Adidas sneakers, my Adidas pants and like a sweater. And they gave me like all the female like sample perfumes. Or they're like, here, ma'am. I get ma'am all the time at Chipotle, at Red Lobster.
Are you like, it's Miss?
Right? I don't care. Unless I'm fully dolled up and it took me 2 hours to get ready to get inside the club for free and get, don't call me he. Like, don't call me he.
All right, let's get to your question about how pink and blue became a thing. We found someone who wrote a book on the subject.
My name is Joe Paoletti. I'm a fashion historian. I study gender and clothing.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, LV.
Joe does not have a YouTube channel, but you have other things in common.
I had the same question that LV had. So when did we start with this pink and blue thing? And I thought that somebody had already done the research and I could just look it up. And it turned out that wasn't true. So the next thing I know, I was studying gender differences in baby and toddler clothing for 40 years now.
And Joe said the story of pink and blue is beyond a rabbit hole.
I think rabbit holes are relatively simple. It's more like a prairie dog village.
You mean a lot of interconnecting tubes?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, shoot.
This is what you got us into, LV.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I gave you guys some work to do.
That's right. Are you ready to burrow through these interconnecting tubes together, my dog? My prairie dog?
Yes, let's go.
The first thing you need to know about pink and blue is that this prairie dog village-shaped rabbit hole was tunneled in U.S. soil.
We're the ones who decided that this was going to be a thing everybody had to do. It's been adopted in other parts of the world as the clothing industry has become more global, but we're the ones that turned it into a cultural imperative. And it appears first with infants.
So let's talk about baby fashion. Baby fashion, like the rangeland of the American prairie dog, has changed a lot in the last 200 years.
Okay.
throughout the 1800s, all babies, girls, boys, whatever, wore the same uniform, a plain white gown.
Because of the baptism?
Because it's practical, easy to bleach, and easy to change a diaper in.
Got it. That makes sense.
But the outfit also reflected how people thought about babies at the time.
The underlying thing is they saw no difference between a baby boy and a baby girl that needed to be made public. Therefore, you dress them the same.
I like that.
Back in the 1800s, Americans thought about babies differently than we do today.
They're just little genderless cherubs.
Sorry, I'm not sure what a cherub is. I'm imported from Mexico City, so English is my second language.
It's like a little baby angel, in this case, with no gender.
That sounds cool. I like that.
Babies even had different pronouns back then. Instead of he or she, parenting books called babies it and baby.
Huh.
Want to try it in a sentence?
Like, it is really annoying. I need to go to sleep.
Perfect. So this is pretty different from now, right?
Yeah, extremely.
But it doesn't mean that people back then had more open ideas about gender.
Sadly, no. I mean, they still felt that that little girl baby was going to grow up to be a wife and mother, and the little boy would grow up to be a husband and father and a provider and have certain expectations in life. So it's not like you can look at the way they're addressing their children and said, wow, what a wonderfully gender-equal society we were living in. We weren't.
The difference was that gender was really tightly linked in people's minds to sex, like the act.
It's hard to convey how creepy a Victorian parent would have thought it was to call a baby a little man.
Oh, like basically that, like we were sexualizing the baby.
Yeah, exactly. And Joe said dressing a baby like a little man would be even creepier. Like putting a baby boy in pants back then would be like putting fake eyelashes, red lipstick, and a wig on a baby girl today.
If you did that to a little girl, just turned her into, like, I'm going to make this little baby look just like the sexiest woman you've ever seen. That's creepy. But they would have thought that if you put a little boy baby in a suit.
Oh, wow.
The brilliant film The Boss Baby would be basically pay-per-view for the Victorians.
Topless and tiaras don't do that.
Are you a big fan of Toddlers and Tiaras?
Well, it was like a guilty pleasure.
It would have been an even guiltier pleasure back then. It doesn't stop at babies. The Victorians would have been horrified to see toddlers or even school-aged kids wearing adult clothing. I want to show you a picture of a kid from the 1880s.
Are you going to email it?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll also put it on our Instagram at ELT Show.
Okay, I got the picture, and it's a little girl, or maybe a boy. Yeah, she or he's wearing a dress. He has little ruffles on her shoulder with a hat, has feathers, he has a ribbon around it, and like shiny black shoes with a little strap around the ankle. She also needs a haircut. Yeah.
Yeah, this kid looks like Shirley Temple with a bowl cut mullet.
Absolutely.
Does this person look familiar at all?
Oh, Jesus. Is it a president?
It is a president.
Shut up.
This is a portrait of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Oh my God. Okay, so I have a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
So you're telling me that every item of clothing that this toddler is wearing was also meant for males?
Yes.
1860s, 1870s, 1880s. If you look at a child of 4 or 5, you can't tell if it's a boy or a girl. You just can't, because the child is going to have long hair. It's going to be wearing a skirt. There's no clues.
A lot changed. That's not even too long ago. Do a lot of people even know that Roosevelt wore dresses, though? Because that would, I think, if more people knew, it would totally change their perspective.
What do you mean?
Be like, hey, look, you want your son to be president? He should wear a dress.
This is how you dress for success.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's zoom in on the end of the 1800s, early 1900s. That's when kids' clothing starts to change.
What happens in that time period is boys' clothing becomes more masculine.
During this time, parents start taking their boys out of dresses earlier, like at age 2 or 3, instead of 6 or 7. They also start giving their little boys short haircuts and putting them into button-down shirts and other grown-up-looking clothes.
The major factor is the desire to distinguish between boys and girls earlier, with particular attention to boys and making them clearly little boys.
And this change in attitude was the first wobbly baby step into a world of pink and blue.
Why? What was that trigger, that little switch from we don't need labels for babies to now we need to label these babies?
That's the big question. We're going to find out after the break. Will you send us to commercial?
Okay. After the break, we'll be back with more. And that's where that song kicks in.
We left off with the question, what made parents want to start differentiating their boys from their girls at a younger age?
I have a feeling there was something happening in history that triggered that.
We had the same hypothesis, which is why we tracked down Hannah Blank.
I'm Hannah Blank, and I am a historian.
Hannah studies the history of gender and sexuality, and she agreed, the emergence of pink and blue is not a straightforward story.
Once you go beyond that surface, you discover that this is really anchored in this incredibly complicated social matrix with so many moving parts, and they're all mutually interdependent.
I.e., it's a prairie dog village.
What she said it was like sounds more complex than a prairie dog village.
I think you're underestimating prairie dog villages.
Oh, maybe I am. I mean, I only see them come out of the hole in documentaries.
There's a lot going on under there, LV.
Oh, okay.
Hannah says the thing you have to know is that during the late 1800s and early 1900s, when parents are starting to take their boys out of dresses at 2 or 3 rather than 6 or 7, America is going through some big societal changes.
Mm-hmm.
And these big changes may help explain the little one we're interested in. So I want to tell you about 3. First, urbanization. In the late 1800s, droves of people were moving off the farm and into cities.
One of the pieces of fallout of industrialization and urbanization is that people perceived that they were losing something by losing their connection to the rural agricultural lifestyle.
Hannah says that for men, that meant losing a connection, I'm paraphrasing, to their garden of manliness.
You're out on the farm and it's an honest day's labor and a man can be a real man, you know, when he's chopping down trees and, you know, shoveling pig poop or whatever. So they come into the city and suddenly they're not outside all day. They're indoors. And the perception was that people who worked in cities are getting soft.
Crisis of masculinity, that's number onesie. Here comes terrible too. Homophobia is really coming into its own during this period, especially for men.
The crisis of masculinity and the fear of homosexuality are really, you know, two sides of the same coin. They're both about this fear that men are not adequately manly. And if men are not adequately manly, then what are they?
Yeah.
In fact, the terms homosexual and heterosexual are coined just a few decades before, in the 1860s. And along with these labels comes the idea that being attracted to the same sex is a mental disorder, one that's possibly preventable.
There comes to be this social awareness that proper manhood is not something that just magically happens. It's something that you have to cultivate.
Okay.
Into this stew of homophobia and masculinity concerns come brand new fields of study around the mind, psychology and psychoanalysis. And practitioners, like Freud, warn parents that babyhood matters. They're like, babies aren't just poop machines you feed and burp. You can mess them up.
There is a newfound concern with this notion of parenting, and that parenting is a job that you need to do correctly. And that's really where the concern with this proper gender formation comes, that they play the right games, that they, you know, go to the right schools, that they learn the right subjects, that they have the right hobbies.
And that they wear the right clothes.
Mm.
So here are the threads. First, you have a society worrying about manhood and sexuality. On top of that, you have psychologists saying how you treat your baby matters. And then all of a sudden, people start caring about what their babies are wearing because they're told that if they get it wrong, their boys won't turn out right.
So it wasn't really just one thing, but it was kind of like a few things that contribute to this labeling.
Yeah, you might say that they're the crisscrossing underground tubes of a prairie dog village that lead us to your tube.
Yes, to my YouTube channel.
Well, it leads to the Pink and Blue tube.
Yeah.
How did Pink and Blue become a shorthand for gender? Let's get back into that non-metaphorical closet with our fashion historian, Joe Paoletti. She said Pink and Blue didn't start out masculine and feminine.
Pink and blue, the pastel form of blue, those were considered kind of youthful colors. So a young girl might wear those colors or a young boy.
Until the early 1900s. That's when pink and blue start to be used to signify gender. And you see it on baby announcement cards, baby blankets, clothing. But there's a wrinkle to the pink and blue rollout.
And what is this wrinkle?
Sometimes it's pink for boys and sometimes it's pink for girls.
Wait, that's crazy.
Let me show you this advice column from 1923.
Dear Helen Brooks, she says, I have always been under the impression that pink is the color used for the printed announcement for the baby boy and blue for the baby girl.
The columnist responded by saying, there is no agreement about which color goes with which gender.
All over the country, it's all different. Depending on where you shopped, it would be pink for boys or pink for girls.
Huh.
It got to the point where national magazines were investigating the question.
There was an article from Time magazine in, I think it was 1927. The Queen of Belgium was having a baby and they were decorating the nursery in pink in anticipation of an heir.
The boy was getting the pink treatment.
And apparently that set hair on fire in the Times office. So they got reporters to call all across the country to department stores saying, is it pink for boys or pink for girls? And all over the country, it's all different.
That's how it was in the 1920s. By the 1950s, it was basically settled. Pink is for girls, blue is for boys.
But who came up with, like, because you want your kid to be masculine, make sure his clothing has blue?
I wish we could say who or what is exactly responsible for this shift. But we don't have, like, a single Tim Gunn figure telling parents how to dress their kids. So here are the theories. One theory has to do with an art sale in the 1920s. This American railroad baron bought two really expensive paintings. One was of a boy wearing blue, and the other was of a girl wearing pink. The sale was highly publicized. A quote in the New York Times compared it to buying the Mona Lisa. So that might have something to do with it. Another theory ties the Mother Goose jingle, Little Boy Blue, to the rise of blue as a masculine color.
Okay.
Some say it was First Lady Mamie Eisenhower's love of pink that cemented it as a girl's color.
Yeah, I can totally see that. I mean, people always look up to, like, the First Lady and, like, what she's wearing and all that.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
Department stores, too, had a vested interest in settling this debate.
They see it as a way to sell things. If you want to sell lots of stuff, you can't give them hand-me-downs. You can't give them things that can be reused from child to child. So there's a real interest in pinkifying things in order to make it less usable. If somebody has another child later on, they're going to have to buy new things for the boy because the boy can't possibly have all the pink things.
Pink and blue is all about the green.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Money.
And this commercial strategy works. By the 1980s, pink isn't just a color for girls. It's only for girls.
It is such a strong symbol of femininity that it is toxic to boys. They can't possibly ride their big sister's worn-out bicycle because it's pink.
Which is nuts, considering that only a few decades earlier, the whole country was split on whether pink was for girls or pink was for boys. What the history tells us is that it could have easily gone the other way.
Yeah, I mean, if there's something to take away from this, is that idea that through time it became super reinforced, but there's no strong idea or reasoning behind it. So therefore, they can become undone easily. You know what I'm saying?
There's no good reason to hang on to it. because there was no good reason for it.
There you go. But I do think it is coming undone, like the whole color thing. Pink, like I had like the most masculine guys like compliment me on my bomber, black and pink bomber jacket.
Really?
Yeah. And Target also doesn't have boy and girl toys. Like they just have the toy section.
All right. Well, here's to the genderless cherubs of the future.
Yeah. To the genderless cherubs of the future.
Cheers.
Cheers.
My prairie dog.
Bye, prairie dog.
While we're talking pink, we have a flamingo update. As longtime listeners know, ELT has been on a campaign to get a pro sports team to adopt the flamingo as a mascot. And that's because the flamingo is a badass creature that can drink boiling water, survive toxic ponds, and many other things, and it deserves more recognition. If you need to be educated, go back to our episode, Don't Underestimate the Flamingo. Because today, we have a big development to share on our quest for flom recognition. Listener Paige brought us the news.
Hi, Flora. My name is Paige, and I have good news for you. There is now a U.S. professional sports team whose official mascot is the flamingo. It is probably due to your relentless campaigning.
That's right, Flamingo Nation. Madison, Wisconsin's pro men's soccer team, it's called Forward Madison FC, has made our dreams come true. And we have Kuba Kujustanek to thank.
I'm the director of fan engagement and digital media here at Forward Madison FC. The mascot was one of my projects for this season.
First things first, I want to congratulate you.
Thank you.
On elevating the best bird in the biological world to where it should be, representing a professional sports team.
That's right. And we're pretty proud. You know, not many teams have celebrated the flamingo so far, so I think a lot of teams have missed the boat.
1,000%.
Yeah.
So why did you go flom?
You know, it's the pink flamingo here in Madison is it's really been a symbol of our city for, you know, 30 years or so. Back in 1979 here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, some students played a prank on the first day of class where they planted 1,008 pink lawn flamingos onto kind of the famous hill on campus, and it became this unofficial symbol of Madison.
So how has it gone over with fans?
All in all, it's gone over great. So I think soccer fans in general just think like, wow, this is super cool.
Or flamingo fans, Kuba.
Or flamingo fans as well. And that's the great crossover there.
What about having it be pink for a men's team? Did anyone balk?
We have had a few comments on social media about that. People are like, you know, I hate the pink. We don't look like we're a serious team. This looks like, you know, we're some sort of joke team. Internally, it didn't bother anyone, and we sold out our pink jersey in 72 hours, so we're not too concerned about the flamingo haters online.
It's like also pink haters.
Yes.
People who are underestimating pink because it's a color associated with women.
Right.
And girls.
Yeah, which the U.S. women's national team is, you know, the best soccer team in the country. So we'd be honored to be associated with a women's team.
Kuba, this is the moment that ELT listeners have been waiting for, the arrival of the flamingo mascot. So tell me about the mascot. I want to know who is in that flamingo suit. I want to know what it looks like. Tell us every detail.
Okay. I don't want to disappoint all the listeners here, but we don't have a flamingo suit mascot for this season.
Excuse me?
Yeah, so we were working on one earlier in the year before our season started. We weren't able to get the design perfectly right. So our mascot right now, we've adopted a 12-week-old dairy calf, kind of to pay homage to our dairy history here in the dairy state.
You're telling me that even though you have flamingos all over your jerseys, your mascot is a baby cow.
Yeah, that's correct. And if you saw her picture, you would fall in love with her. So
I'm sure she's delightful, Pooba.
We do visit our flamingo brethren at the zoo. Then we had our players go out and visit them a couple weeks ago. We actually got to go in the pen.
I feel like you're changing the subject.
No. We're doing the flamingos right. We're just, you know.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think there's more work to be done here.
There's always more flamingo work to be done. I agree with that.
Well, Kuba, who do we address the letters to? Because our fans will not rest. This is going to be very disappointing news. Like I hate to say it. This is going to be a big, big disappointment for ELT fans.
And we of course don't want to let them down. So, you know, we'd love to see your guys' messages. We can definitely share it on to our ownership.
Wait, so the people I need to talk to about getting a flamingo mascot are the ownership?
Yeah, I mean, you can send it to me too, and I'll filter through to them.
You're going to handle me now?
No.
What do you think our chances are of getting someone in a flamingo suit?
I don't want to promise anything, but I'll go over 50%. Let's say like 75.
Those are great odds.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're almost there.
Kuba, prepare for a tidal wave of feedback.
We're looking forward to it. We love the passion from the flamingo community.
Let's bring the passion, ELT listeners. We are so close to getting a flamingo mascot. Let's make this happen. Address your strongly worded pro flamingo mascot tweets and Instagram messages to @forwardmsnfc and CCS @ELT Show. We will amplify. And a big important announcement, ELT is hiring a new producer. Do you work in radio and podcasting and have a pro flamingo outlook? Come work with us. You can find the job post at gimletmedia.com/careers.
Every Little Thing is produced by Aaron Reese, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka, Chad Chinai, and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Caitlin Kenny and Jorge Just. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. Scored by Dara Hirsch. Special thanks to Elizabeth Sweet, Catherine Parkin, and Valerie Steele. We are flamily. I live in a prairie dog town. Goodbye.